Welcome to the panel discussion on the laws of vulnerabilities, which is going to be primarily hosted by Gerhard Eschelbach, the CTO and VP of Engineering for Qualys. I'm Richard Thieme, and I'm here to simply get things inaugurated and moving along. Gerhard currently manages the largest and most up-to-date vulnerability database in the world. He also helps to protect over 1,000 corporate networks, including Mercedes and Blue Cross Blue Shield. He's a respected teacher, speaker, researcher, and writer. He's published widely, holds several patents, and he is going to present the fruits of his research on vulnerabilities to which the panel will then respond. Our panel, beginning at the right side, include Marianne Davidson, who graciously stepped in for Howard Schmidt, who could not be here. Marianne is the Chief Security Officer of Oracle. She's responsible for Oracle's product security, corporate infrastructure security, and security policies, as well as security evaluations, assessments, and incident handling. Next to her is Mark Lovelace, also known as, Phil Zimmerman. I thought the upset was because I used his real name. Next is Phil Zimmerman, who I'm not going to say a lot about. He did the opening keynote this morning, and everybody knows that he is the inventor, creator of PGP, Pretty Good Privacy, and is graciously on our panel again. Jeff Moss, also, everybody knows, is the founder and CEO of Black Hat and the founder of DEF CON, and he's worked for other places like Ernst & Young and Secure Computing and done other things, but he's pretty much focused on making these conferences work and has taken Black Hat worldwide. Next to him is Mark Lovelace, a.k.a. Simple Nomad, the founder of the Nomad Mobile Research Center, an international group of hackers that explore technology. But by day, disguised as a mild-mannered senior security analyst for VineView Corporation, he has spent years developing and testing various computer systems for security strengths. He's written plenty of papers. You can read a number of them on the web. He's developed a number of tools for testing the security and insecurity of computer systems, and he frequently lectures at security conferences and is often quoted by those who do such things. Last but not least, J.D. Glazer is president and CEO of NT Objectives. Over 10 years' experience in security assessment, application, and defense development. His expertise and commitment to the security industry is demonstrated through many free network and forensic tools, which he has provided through his company, NT Objectives. He has been tapped by Tripwire and Foundstone to lead the development of their security products. Currently, NT Objectives has recently released the Fire and Water Toolkit, designed specifically to address large-scale web security issues. And now, to present the fruits of his research and get us going, Mr. Gerhard Eschelbach.
Good afternoon, everybody. Well, I'm not a lawyer, but I've been in the security industry for a number of years. Working on products including McAfee, antivirus, PGP, with Build Together, CyberCop, and for the past 2.5-3 years, working on development and bringing to life Qualys Guard web service. The law of vulnerabilities, let me give you a little bit of a background about this project, what it is about, and how it all started. If you look at the security industry, we have a tremendous amount of data available today about attacks and alerts, where they're happening, where they're coming from, and we can do a lot of research on this data. On the other hand, there's not a lot of data available today about the internet, the state of the internet, about vulnerabilities, where they are, how prevalent they are, which ones are relevant, and so forth. So the idea really here of this research project was to start an initiative to get an understanding, get a better picture of where vulnerabilities are, how prevalent they are, and how quickly is the industry responding to fixing them on the internet. So I started this effort about 1.5 years ago as an effort to collect and gather statistical data about vulnerabilities on the internet, what's out there, where they are. And it's very important to mention that this data is completely anonymous. It is not attachable to any individual IP address or to any individual user whatsoever. It's automatically being collected by the QualysGuard platform, so everybody who is looking for scanning is being part of this collective set of statistical data. And I will get into this much more in detail as we move along. So this tremendous amount of data set allows to do some really, really interesting research and analyze how patterns are actually behaving from a vulnerability perspective on the internet. So the collection of data that we have available that I looked specifically here is the result of about 1.5 million IP scans on the internet on a wide variety of systems there. It gathered about 1.2 critical vulnerabilities, and I do not talk in this presentation about vulnerabilities that are not necessarily high priority or important. This is critical vulnerabilities. Interestingly enough, we're not living in a pure Microsoft and Linux world. You have a wide variety of systems out there. You will find all kinds of different systems on the internet, and which has been reflected in the fact that there is more than 2,040 unique vulnerabilities that have been gathered during the time. So this is very important to emphasize and realize on that as well. So based on this data, what can you do with this amount of data? So you have a pool of data that gives you at any point in time what vulnerabilities are being found and identified anywhere on the internet. It's a lot of statistical data. And so some of the analysis that I conducted on this data was first of all looking how big is the window of exposure. If a new vulnerability comes out, how long does it take the community to respond and take action and fix it on the systems there? Secondly, also looking how long are vulnerabilities living? Are they living forever? Are vulnerabilities dying down? Are they gonna be gone at some point in time? All those questions were interesting to look at from this data perspective. Also, how quickly does the industry respond to new vulnerabilities, as well as looking at trending information over time. How do vulnerabilities evolve? What is the prevalence of vulnerabilities over time? And all these data points obviously gave great information to look at. So I'm bringing onto the slides now a number of charts that are built based on this real world data of live vulnerabilities. Let me give you this example here of the Microsoft WebDAV vulnerability, which was released in March this year. So basically 4 months ago. And what you see on this chart here is on the left side here is the prevalence, how many of those types are out there or found at any point in time over time. And what you see here is a very typical pattern of response. So the purple line here is the real number of vulnerabilities being identified and found at any point in time, and the dotted line is an estimation, a trend line I computed and calculated based on that. So that's a very typical response. What we see here is that there is initially very quick response, quick fixing, and then it's kind of slowing down, and the decay of vulnerabilities is weakening very quickly. So if I look at another one, there's another data set here, which is an IBM Lotus Notes vulnerability. Very similar patterns. Another vulnerability that was released in March this year. Very similar behavior. Initially, very quick response, but then it's decaying off very quickly. So what that allowed to do here is to look specifically into those patterns and define what's called the half-life. And the half-life of vulnerabilities, if you look at all the statistical data, it's about 30 days on average for critical vulnerabilities. It takes about 30 days on the internet to get about 50% of the vulnerabilities fixed there. And this pattern is very consistent with a number of vulnerabilities that are looked specifically and did the analysis and research for. If you continue on there and look at a more longer term trend, this is a vulnerability that is out since more than a year, actually it's April 2002. You see exactly the same behavior as well here. You see a very quick initial response and then it's decaying off and it's rather flat or rather static. There's not a lot of change going on there. And you can take numerous examples for that. This is another one that really was interesting to see. Systems that still have SSL v2 enabled on the internet out there. There's a tremendous amount of systems out there, but the fixing rate is enormously slow happening there. And it really led me to another interesting observation. If you look at it and believe that vulnerabilities at some point will be gone, it's true for a lot of vulnerabilities. But on the other hand, there is a number of vulnerabilities actually coming back. And what does it mean they are coming back? It means that there is something going on that helps to bring vulnerabilities back to life. Let's take a look at the Code Red vulnerability, the one that was used by Code Red, originally released and announced in 2001, so more than 2 years ago. And it was pretty well under control for some point in time. But slowly but surely, it's coming back now. And I have talked to a number of people in the industry, what could be the phenomena here that's going on there. And I think the most common theory here is that organizations still do rollouts of servers and devices on an image base, take images that they have pre-configured for their needs, for their requirements, put them out there, and may not be applying appropriate patches there. So that's probably one of the unique conclusions I reached based on that. But also an interesting observation is SQL Slammer. Very quick, immediate response when it hits, but it's on the way back and it's coming back as we see here on this data sheet here. So what's the impact of an exploit? I also did some analysis of, now we know what's the window of exposure here. We have defined the window of exposure, obviously, as the area where this is the most critical time for an exploit to hit. And if you do the correlation and the analysis, I looked at those vulnerabilities that I was referring to, and I came up with 80% of the vulnerabilities have an exploit available within the first 60 days. So within the two first time spans of the half-life, within 30 days, 60 days, within those 60 days, you have about 80% of the vulnerabilities of the exploits available to exploit those vulnerabilities. So that's obviously a tremendous opportunity and a tremendous breeding ground for worms to leverage this window of opportunity and have available 80% of the exploits for those respective vulnerabilities. On a related but slightly different type of analysis, I looked into this data as well from a prevalence perspective. And what I was looking here is basically what vulnerabilities are out there and how frequent are they appearing on the internet. This is a collective data for the past 1.5 years. And what you see here is an interesting pattern of about 10 or 15 most prevalent vulnerabilities that are happening most frequently out on the internet. And so having this information available, looking into how this is happening from a trending perspective, is this changing actually? Are those 10 consistent, or are they changing over time? And so I did some comparison here on a month-by-month base and took up here from July 2002 to January 2003 to July 2003. And you see an interesting pattern here of a sliding window that's happening, which allowed me, and I did this for pretty much every month in the year. I just published here the month that I'm talking about here. And when I look at the overall picture, it's about 50% of the most prevalent vulnerabilities at any given time are being changed during the year and are being replaced by new ones. And the most popular example that you all are familiar with is the DCOM vulnerability that was announced 16th of July, just two weeks ago, it made it into the top 10 within the first 2 days. That's a typical example of how this shift is actually happening in real time. So it's not a static list of vulnerabilities that are happening, but it's a small, confined list of the ones that we need to be alert and that we need to be aware about. So let me give you the two recent examples, which I think are pretty telling here. One I mentioned already, which is the DCOM vulnerability that hit on July 16. And within the first 2 days, it was in the most top 10 most prevalent list, obviously because of the statistical data I have at any point in time given prevalency information. And this is pretty interesting to see here. It's since July 20, for the last 10 days, it's ranking number one vulnerability. So there is certainly a clear opportunity, and I think the messages are already out there about a potential larger scale attack on this particular vulnerability. So the key message here is this is something that I think is changeable, and I will come back to this with specific ways how those patterns can be defeated with. The next example is Interestingly enough, the Cisco vulnerability hit the same day, but it never made it up to the top 10. It's right now ranking 29 on the top most prevalent list. So we're not even publishing it as one of that's part of the most critical list there. And why? I think there was a tremendous amount of effort by the vendor in this particular case to really make the fixing a success out on the internet. I think this was an extremely well-coordinated effort from the vendor side to make sure this vulnerability is fixed before it can be exploited and before it can be used as a larger scale attack. So there is factors like that are clearly part of the decision tree and as part of the impact on vulnerability prevalence and exploitability. So let me now go to the step of summarizing all those points being made here so far and summarizing the four major points, the four major laws of vulnerabilities. The first, the half-life of critical vulnerabilities is 30 days. That's based on all this data we have available. And it doubles with obviously lowering degrees of severity of vulnerabilities. The second one, we talked about that, it's about 50% of the most prevalent vulnerabilities are changing during the course of a year. So it's not a static list, it's a changing list during the course of the year. The persistence of vulnerabilities is another interesting subject. We mentioned about the fact that some of them are coming back. So the life of some vulnerabilities is unlimited, and it's been unlimited until those types of technologies are eliminated, which is in a lot of technologies that we're using today, very unlikely gonna be the case. And lastly, 80% of the exploits are available within 60 days of release of the vulnerability, and therefore are right within the window of exposure. And that's really part of what we'd like to discuss now in the panel discussion with the team here to find out. And I will then come back at the end and we'll give also some suggestions on what we can do. Thank you so much.
Okay, who would like to respond?
Yeah, I had a few notes on this, and I wanted to communicate some information about this. I think there's a fairly good chance that there may be some black hat types actually in this room. Maybe by day they do something else and manage to get to this conference, but there are some probably some black hats here. I thought the curve stuff was interesting in a lot of this. However, the thing is that there are already a large number of black hats that are aware of exactly, I mean, this has always been the case. The black hats have known that if they start going out and using these exploits, immediately someone's going to figure it out and someone's going to start patching and whatnot. So there is kind of an underground commodities market that exists where these things are traded and used and bartered and whatnot. And a lot of times it's like, don't use this unless you absolutely have to, because if this gets out, then it's going to, you know, make my life difficult or whatever. But there's a lot of awareness already in the underground culture, and they have already been ramping up their efforts to a large extent because they know they have an extremely short window in which to work, particularly once a vendor releases a patch for it. Once a vendor releases a patch for it, immediately those that didn't have the information about the exploit began reverse engineering processes, looking at the differences between the DLL that was replaced or the source code that was changed, and actually going in there and figuring out what that particular vulnerability is. It happened with DCOM. I don't know, has everyone seen this stuff that's posted publicly on the DCOM exploit stuff that went out publicly? Am I correct? Okay, I personally saw five different copies by five different individuals that had wrote this stuff. Some of the stuff was released within 24 hours of the announcement from Microsoft regarding the thing. So, I mean, there are people that work extremely fast in this. So just be aware that while all this is fairly interesting on that curve, knowing it is basically something that the I think the underground community is already extremely well aware of and has already tried to make adjustments for.
I'd second that, but I'd say it's sort of the exception to the rule. Is that this seems like it's the 90% solution or the risk manager's solution. Sort of the longer you can stay away from the trouble, the better off you are. And so I guess, as a practicing security guy who's really paranoid, you know, there's never a solution that's good enough for me. But I think these charts actually, his work on the statistics validates, I guess, what we've always considered to be sort of a rule of thumb. I haven't really seen it in many other studies on this, so I'd have to say it's nice to validate this is sort of what we talk about in the back room. Now there's math to back it up, so I guess that means it's going to be taken more seriously by some of people in management. That said, though, don't you think there's a strong case in management just to delay? If you can just, you know, dodge the bullet long enough, you might not have to patch anything. So I think corporate culture is going to digest this. You're going to see some weird convolutions, just like the way insurance impacts the way you handle risk. So I don't know, what was the intention? What do you think, Gerhardt, the response from corporate America is to this information? Is it going to help us or is it going to hurt us?
I think if you look at the data that we visualize here, it's as Jeff mentioned, it's data we all knew. It's not a surprise what the outcome here is. But I think the interesting thing is now we have it in facts and we have it in numbers. And the interesting thing as well is we make it available to anybody on the community. It's no longer, this information is no longer privy or limited to the people with bad intentions. It's basically available to anybody, and anybody can take action based on this data that we have it now in black and white. So that was really the intention, to be able to, and I'm going to come back to this after the panel discussion, talk about the specifics on how we can help the community and focus on those most prevalent top 10 vulnerabilities and how quickly we need to address them to remove some of the breeding grounds for worms.
I have a quick comment. So you could almost use this statistically to determine the top 10, the most critical action items, and then maybe not spend all your effort on the ones that are not showing up as, or the older tool.
That's exactly correct. So the idea here is really to come up with this most prevalent list of vulnerabilities on an ongoing base, update this list in real time. As I mentioned, the defining moment last week or 2 weeks ago was DCOM, but I'm sure there is another one coming in August and September. So those regularly updated top 10 list of most prevalent vulnerabilities, and then provide this information to the security community at large and be able to address those vulnerabilities firsthand.
I actually have a question I wanted to ask. I took a note here. Now, the IP addresses that were scanned, were these, who were these people? These Qualys customers, or?
It's a mix. Basically, it's a mix of people who did a free evaluation of Qualys. It's also a mix of customers. So it's a wide variety of set of statistical evidence from the internet. So it's not just limited to customers or limited to evaluation. It's a wide variety. It's literally covering thousands of networks.
Okay. Was this just done, say, with the United States? Is this an international thing?
Globally. The internet globally.
Okay.
I have no data points about where they are, but I know it's a global effort because we make available the infrastructure from anywhere to the internet.
The reason I'm asking, because I was wondering about how much of the results that you managed to get, say, from the Pacific Rim, which is a real nice hotbed for launch points of said attacks using said vulnerabilities. And I didn't know how much data that you gathered from those, because in a very real sense, when you have things like denial of service attacks or worms or whatnot, you know, using those areas as launch points and everything, it would be good to gather more data from there to see if by region if these worked out the same.
Part of the requirement really was for us to keep this data completely anonymously. I have no data visibility into where they came from. And that was a very important requirement on when we set up this project. So I have no data about where those vulnerabilities come. But within 1.5 million scans, you can assume that you pretty much cover the whole world.
The one thing you have to assume then is the people, these 1.5 million scans were performed by people who had enough of a clue to determine that they needed a scan.
Right.
So I have a feeling that if you actually applied this to the internet as a whole, it would be much scarier.
So. I think you have a very good point here.
So I'd actually like to address, I think, what some of the people on the vendor side can do. And I think if you are a vendor, you're relieved at the point to be not in the top 10, but you're not deluded that you couldn't end up there. And I do think that a lot of these issues are industry problems and not, you know, vendor X or vendor Y's problem. So one of the issues that comes up is an interesting dichotomy. Occasionally, researchers will complain that when vendors do release alerts, they don't publish enough information in there. And the interesting dichotomy is that if you are a vendor, you're in business to protect your customers. Researchers, by and large, are not your customers. So you need to put enough information in that alert that you make the customer aware of how bad is it? Is it severity one, severity two, and what does that mean? Do I have to apply it right this second, or can I wait? Is there a workaround, and where do I get the patch? And what you don't want to do is draw a roadmap. So it's interesting because I've never had customers come back and say, I needed more information. The things that they want are kind of how bad is it, do I need to apply it right this second, and where do I get the patch? So again, you don't, from the vendor side, you know, yes, I do know that the black hats may well go out and figure out how to exploit this anyway, but if you are a vendor, you should err on the side of protecting customers, right? You don't need to be in the business of making it possible for researchers to understand exactly what the problem was. I know a lot of people will disagree with that. They say, well, we need to know how to write better code. But again, from the vendor perspective, you need to know how to make your developers write better code. If there is something that is an industry issue, then yes, as a good citizen, you need to share with your ISAC or with other people who might have that problem, because you don't want your, even people competitors, to get whacked, and we already have mechanisms for doing that. But again, protect the customer first. The second thing that comes up, and again, industry can do better here, simple, test the patches. One of the problems that customers have is, first of all, a lot of people cannot apply patches immediately because you're not going to patch your production system in the last 2 weeks of your fiscal year, right? If you need your mission critical systems to work, you may not touch it, or you're certainly not going to apply something until you know that it doesn't break, you know, your business applications or your infrastructure. So, you know, what can vendors do? Well, one of the things you can do is to make sure that, as a minimum, any one-off patch gets a decent test, and also that makes its way into a patch set that goes through a full set of regressions. And in fact, we make our developers, you not only have to write a test, but you have to make sure that it goes into regression so you never reintroduce that fault again. And we run regressions every single night against our entire code base to make sure that when somebody checks in something new, they don't break something old. The problem with security issues is people don't apply the patches, and a lot of times the reason they don't apply the patches is they're afraid it's going to break something. So vendors, we can all do a better job of making sure that customers have confidence that when we give them something, it's not going to break. And this all seems very, very straightforward, but you know, people are really afraid of breaking their systems. The third thing that vendors need to do, and again, I laud Qualys for having these kind of testing for the presence of a vulnerability without creating an exploit, because you don't need to do that. But vendors do need to do a better job of saying, okay, if you can build very good software, you can have very good security functionality. If you don't make it easy for your customers to be secure and remain secure, then you're failing them. So we all need to do a better job of creating tools that will tell you, have you hardened your systems appropriately? And that could include, as you're aware of new vulnerabilities, workarounds for those issues, number one. And number two, have you applied a patch? Now, have you applied a patch? You don't necessarily need to know, test, create an exploit to know, to be able to tell their customers whether they've applied the patch or not. In fact, there are other reasons for you to do this. For example, somebody calls up your support center and says, I got this problem. Okay, what version are you running? Well, I'm running 8.1.7. And then you take 20 minutes before you find out that they're not really running that version, they're running a different version. So you have every possible incentive to create the means by which you can give your customers tools to say, hey, guess what? I've looked at your network, you can run this tool, and by the way, you haven't applied the last two critical security patches. So yes, it is an arms race. It definitely is. There are a number of things that vendors can do. You know, the obvious one is build better software. What I'd like to see happen, one of the things I would really like to come out of Black Hat, is the same creative energy that some of you are using to create exploits. You use that same creative energy to help people have automated ways of building better software. Because even the vendors and all of us really have the mantra, you train all your developers, you make it part of their compensation, you have good development processes, you do all this testing. All it takes is for somebody to miss 1 out of 20 buffer overflow conditions, and it still costs you $1 million to fix the hole, and people make mistakes. I've seen a lot of people come in my door trying to sell me some whiz-bang thing that will do such and such, and almost nobody who can really solve the real problem, which is help me automate better secure coding practice. That is a godsend, and you know, if you can take all your creative juices and put it on helping people do a better job, I guess you're putting yourselves out of business. So maybe it's too much to ask, but really most people want to build better software. We just need more automated ways of doing it.
JD?
All right. .NET. Just to add to what she was saying, from a tool builder perspective, one of the scary things that Gerhard highlighted is this 30-day half-life. You know, within that time period, there's 4 essential things that have to happen. You know, you have to build the tool, add the patch, you know, create a new scanning device, you know, whatever you're going to do to deal with the problem. You have to release it. It has to go through distribution to whoever's going to use it or who needs it. And then there's the installation of the process, and all those things take time. And doing all of those within 30 days is pretty difficult considering all of the people involved. I think one of the most interesting new developments out there on the web is, you know, VulnXML and projects similar to that. VulnXML, for those that don't know, is a community project to put into a common format, you know, attack signatures to help with scanning. The problem is that it's, you know, it's not very funded, and we all need paychecks, and we're all, you know, motivated by money. And so something that could be as valuable as that in assisting all of us in helping to try to meet this 30-day deadline, it would be interesting to see if some type of, you know, funded conversion of efforts could take place between all of us so that, you know, we don't, because we're all running around repeating the same steps and we're all facing the same Herculean task. So to me, it just highlights the ability to put something like that together so that it's profitable. I mean, everyone sucks off the internet to, you know, get your information and put into your tools, and security companies are very guilty of this, you know, and hoarding it. But there really needs to be a much more powerful effort to really share the answers and make it speedy.
You know, in response to your question about automated tools for improving the security of the code, there is a programming language called Cyclone that is a variant of C that makes it very difficult to write code that allows buffer overflow attacks. It seems that so many of these attacks, so many of these vulnerabilities are buffer overflow attacks. I don't know what the percentage is. Does anybody know how prevalent that is in the total number of vulnerabilities? Yeah. So this may seem to be kind of draconian to suggest this, but if everybody converted all their C source code to Cyclone, which is very close to C, only minor tweaks to the syntax of a few things involving pointers would be necessary, and then your code would probably not have any more buffer overflow vulnerabilities. So there, 70% of the vulnerabilities would vanish. That's an automated tool in development. I don't know if that would do it, but yeah. And I can't guarantee that. I'm just, you know, I looked at the programming language and spec, and I saw they designed it specifically. I guess whoever designed it just was driven entirely by buffer overflow fears and designed the language to prevent that. I have other things to say unrelated to that, but.
Go ahead, Phil.
I could say in my own personal experience with PGP that that there's, you know, when I look at the public awareness of vulnerabilities that have been found in PGP when we've had bugs, they really rake us over the coals, and because because of the difference in trust. There's been two or three examples of vulnerabilities in PGP that have been fixed very rapidly, but it was a very traumatic experience because of the public reaction to it. The public reaction to vulnerabilities in Microsoft software is apathy, you know. Everybody just rolls their eyes and say, oh, there's another one, you know. Nobody worries about backdoors in Microsoft software because no one cares, because they think that the actual bugs in there are probably more exploitable than any backdoors and more real. But in PGP, because of the enormous, the politics of trust, because of the enormous trust in the product, you know, we have to be held to a higher standard, and so we're traumatized a lot more about it. The worst experience we ever had was, we have a feature in PGP called the additional decryption key, which is used to have corporate access to encrypted data, and we had a vulnerability in that, and they killed us over that politically. I mean, everybody hated the feature to begin with because it was put in during the crypto revolution when we were in a pitched battle with the FBI, and so when they found the vulnerability, nobody informed us in advance to give us time to fix it. Instead, the guy that found it gleefully announced it publicly, you know, and there was this sort of this kind of festival of revenge against this feature that everybody hated, which nobody had to use, you know, but. We were caught with our pants down, and we had a patch out within 18 hours of finding out about it. It was an absolutely horrible 18 hours. When I see just every couple of weeks another vulnerability from in Windows, I kind of envy the luxury they have of the public not caring about it and being glad that I'm not them, because the public has more trust in my product. So, yeah.
Just on your comment as far as the apathy goes towards, and this doesn't just necessarily apply towards Microsoft. It applies to a lot of large companies. Basically, what it boils down to is you have a lot of large companies that are pushing software out the door as fast as they can. Essentially, what they're doing is they're feeding us shit sandwiches, is what they're doing. Okay, and I don't care if you say, all right, we changed our process. We're using really good bread. Okay, we put some honey Dijon on there. Okay, this is fresh shit sandwich that we're giving. Doesn't really help. I mean, there are some things, some processes that have been put in place by a lot of these companies. Microsoft's a real easy target because, I mean, I've looked at some of his next slides coming up, and there's, you know, a list of vulnerabilities, the top 10, and Microsoft's half of them. I mean, there are other companies that still are doing the exact same type of thing, and I agree with the comments that we do need better coding practices. I like the suggestion of let's come up with some automated processes to try to catch this on the front end. That it should be obvious to anyone right now that the whole thing is just a complete broken system. You have companies that are constantly releasing software that is constantly being found with bugs in it, and then there's this whole cycle of things. I mean, I work for a company that, you know, is in part funded by the insecurity of other companies. I mean, part of it's also, you know, managing all this stuff, but that's a part of it. You're managing all of these security vulnerabilities. We need to start, I mean, it's good to talk about, but there has to be some type of serious action on the front end. Maybe something along the lines, this has been suggested, I know here at Black Hat before, that you actually have legislation in place to actually hold some of these companies accountable. Okay, you don't own their software anyway, you just license it. Maybe if you actually could take them to court and say, your vulnerability cost me some actual money, I want my money back on that and then some because of my hurt reputation. Maybe there needs to be something to give them more of a financial incentive to actually create stuff that's pretty decent in the first place.
Mary Ann, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, I would. And, you know, you weren't singling us out. Thank you very much. But I do, this is sort of the market reality check on, the vendors don't care. They want to shovel their product out the door. So here's the deal. I mean, we have a very draconian release process. What is relatively lowly at Oracle VP, I have the authority to stop any product shipment. All right? So there are people who are more senior than me in the company. I get to stop the shipment if it's not ready to go. We have formal secure coding standards. We train everybody on them. We have a formal development process, and security is part of every step. It's functional test and design specifications. We have release checklists. One of the things that we do is make every single component owner on the bill of materials complete a questionnaire that we've designed to try to weed out common security flaws. And we also, in some cases, we say, okay, what are the top four types of things you're always getting bitten on? Go through your code line by line and look for those type of issues. Now, I'm not telling you that we have perfect software. We definitely think security is a deal breaker for shipment. It has been for years. It's not. I'm always amazed when I hear some vendors say, and you know, we stop product shipment for security issues. Yeah, well, duh, of course you do that. And you're asking, what is the economic incentive? If we have a flaw, because we run on so many operating systems, okay, this is just the economic incentive. It has nothing to do with reputation. And in my mind, that's the most important thing. We have customers I can't name. Everybody, one of our customers has secrets. Some of them are national secrets. Those are the people I worry about. Because if something I failed to do, their systems will be at risk. That accountability I take very seriously. Monetarily, if we, technical term, screw it up, and I have a security fault that's on all versions of product, on all operating systems, in the worst case, we've done 78 patches to fix it, which we gladly did to protect our customers. That's $1 million. All right? That does not include the cost to us of patching our own systems. We run our company and our own software, right? So we have to protect our own networks, which is also a very high incentive. And I think most vendors are in that position. It doesn't include the cost to our customers of patching their systems, which I guess The Economist estimates at $900 per server and $700 per client. That's the average cost to patch. Start doing the math based on numbers of servers and numbers of clients. We're talking real money. So you're talking about, well, they don't have any incentive to do that. You have every incentive. It's extreme. Anything I do in development to avoid those kinds of faults is significant cost avoidance. And I can think a lot of things I'd rather do with $1 million than fix an avoidable, preventable security fault. And I don't like standing in front of customers and saying, I'm sorry, we have this kind of a problem. Right? So I have every, and I think most vendors do, you have, if you do the math, not to mention you value your customers and you value your corporate reputation, you have every possible incentive to treat your customer systems as if they were yours. But what we need is more help doing it. I mean, for every, snake oil company who comes in and wants to sell me some, it slices, it dices, it makes Julian Fry's security solution, I'd like to see somebody coming in who says, look, I can help you actually find these things in a more automated fashion. Because it's not fun going through millions of lines of code by hand. And there are some tools out there, I'm just beginning to see them, whoever you venture capitalists are out there funding those companies, God bless you, because that is the right problem to solve. Not band-aid it afterwards. We're gonna need that, I think, as long as people write software and they're not perfect. But boy, I'd like to have fewer specialty firewalls and better code so we don't have to have all these products that are sort of trying to prevent attacks and figure out whether you've applied patches. We can do a better job, we just need more automated tools to do that.
Nomad?
I just wanted to point out that as the bright attackers, you know, the top 10%, I guess, the non-script kiddies that are developing exploits, I guess stack overflows of our old news, and a lot of the newer ones are being done in heap overflows, and that's kind of interesting. But everybody is looking forward to the day, even if all the overflows are killed, there's still the double freeze and the off by ones and more esoteric, more complex code problems, and it makes actually some of the bug hunters happy, because that means only they and their friends will have the skills to find these vulnerabilities. And if the vast unwashed can't find anything, that means the stuff they've got is more valuable, which means then there's less.
You're saying we shouldn't make it better because then only the skilled
can find it. I'm saying that as you approach solving the problem, right? The only people left to find the problems and point them out are the most skilled. And even if they're the most skilled attacker, they have a very small incentive to release it. Where if I in my spare time can find a bug, I don't care. I'll give it away. You know, I'll announce it. But if it takes me weeks and weeks of research on an esoteric problem, I think you'll see a weird invert problem where as you reach that 90%, you reach that 90% solution.
Wouldn't there be a correlation between programming skill and an anti-correlation between programming skill and the criminal element?
Well, criminal, or you mean foreign governments or foreign?
Well, foreign governments, of course, it's the other way because they hire the best they can get,
right.
And the people are patriotically motivated, I guess. So, yeah. At the AES conference, there were three AES conferences. At the last AES conference, Brian Snow stood up and said that he was listening to a lot of people talk about their philosophies about data security, and he said that he seems to hear a lot of rationale for data security that's based on the concept of liability. And so you think about, if you make a mistake, then maybe you're liable for a certain amount of money. And he said that in his work, he doesn't really think about liability at all, because Brian Snow is NSA's, he's the head of InfoSec at NSA, or he was at the time. And he said in his line of work, they don't think of liability, they think of people dying. You know, if he makes a mistake, somebody dies. And he said to me during the break that that one thing he liked about PGP and my design attitude toward PGP was that I had the same attitude. And so it seems like a lot of the behavior of companies about these patches or responding to bug reports is purely an economic approach. I particularly liked your remarks about how you felt a moral obligation because of the the fact that it's used in critical situations. There are some people that have that attitude, but a lot of them, they're looking at it purely in economic terms.
Nomad, you want to? Well, I wanted to make sure Nomad was at rest.
I had a couple of funny things I could have thrown in there for Marianne, but I won't. It's just, Well, no, I was just going to ask what you were describing, whether that was the fresh bread or was that the honey Dijon. But, I mean, the point being that you, and I'm not necessarily picking on you. I'm so great that, that Oracle is, what was the term, unbreakable that you used in your, Okay. All right, but nonetheless, I mean, the thing is that in spite of all these things, marketing's come, yeah, in spite of all these things that were put in place, there's still problems in the system. That is my point. Now maybe things, granted, looking at some of the lists of the affected vendors, no, you're not in the top 10 that often. That's a good thing for you. There are other vendors who are. Okay, there are other vendors who actually are much more frequently, and I think that's a really big concern.
Yeah, let me take this to the audience now. Adam, you've had your hand up for some time, and if you could ask a question that doesn't involve the use of bread or other food metaphors, it would be great. All right. Marianne? JD?
I just want to add a little bit to what you're saying, because I agree with that. I think
Why would you do it?
He said something about a sandwich. No, he basically said it's fundamentally hard to build good software, and I believe that that's true, because there's two mindsets at work here. You take a really good, competent software engineer, and to build something well is a completely different mindset from trying to break it. And people who make software aren't usually in the mindset of breaking it. And one of the things that we sit up here and we all fantasize is that we're going to turn all of our engineers into people who have a mindset to break everything. And if we had a magic tool that eliminated buffer overflows, people who want to break into something are just going to look for another mechanism to break into something, and then we're right back to where we started. So it's much more than just saying we're going to improve our quality, or we have some current software problems that are easy, but it's far more than that. There's two different things at war here.
You mentioned the evaluated products list. One of the things that does need to change in the market for things to change is people do need to be more discriminating consumers. And that doesn't mean I'm blaming the victim. But one of the evaluations, and we've done them for years and years, and we've begun extending them actually to more and more products. Formal security evaluations certainly do not create perfect software. I don't think anything does. But one of the things that it does is it forces you to a decent development process. And let's face it, at least 90% of this issue is cultural. You know, I think there's about 90% ignorance and 10% hubris in the development community. But security evaluations force you to a secure development process, because that's really what the evaluators are looking at. They're not just tire kicking your code for a couple of weeks. Okay, you say you're secure. How did you build your software? Where's the architecture document? Where are the functional design and test specifications? I want to look at how you store your source code. In fact, I'm going to look at your source code. So having done them for years, one of the things that has happened for us is it's sort of baked security into the development process and into the development culture. Now, customers, actually the federal government, specifically DOD, has made a really good stand by saying, and they claim they really mean it this time, it's in the Defense Authorization Bill, that for national security systems, they will only use evaluated products. And what is a national security system? Well, it's not just super secret spy databases. It includes things like the human resources system for the armed forces. If the U.S. federal government, which has huge purchasing power, really means it this time and they stick to their guns, it's going to change the marketplace, because people will have to change the way they build software. They won't just be able to throw it over the wall and have somebody debug it for them. That is not going to create a perfect world, but it will. I've seen even small vendors say, hey, listen, I've got to deal with this evaluation thing. I need to do it at a reasonable level of assurance, which means I have to change the way I build software. That is actually a great thing. If this were extended to DHS systems, and frankly, if DHS is not doing national security, then what are they doing? That would be another way for the government to use their purchasing power, and that would help change the market. I agree it will not create a perfect world. In fact, although we've done evaluations for years, we've extended what that is to do different types of risk assessments. In fact, we created a hacking team whose job it is to break our own networks and products, because that's another thing that we can do to help make sure that our products are good before they leave the gate, and then what we learn from hacking goes back into the development process. So there is no magic bullet, but there are a lot of things you can do, and quite honestly, at the end of the day, if you buy buggy, crappy software, you're going to get buggy, crappy software. If you start holding your vendors' feet to the fire and making security a purchasing criterion, the market will change. And if you don't, it's not.
A question? Yes. Thank you.
I'm just getting ready to jump in there as soon as you're. No, I was saying that the industry, the software industry, makes it very difficult to do that. I can't just go get five firewalls and do a comprehensive test and release it because the licensing software says I can't do that. I can't release unapproved tests of the software, unapproved comparisons. So that could be part of the shrink wrap license. So it makes it very difficult for independent people to release comprehensive tests. I'm not picking on you. I'm just saying, as a whole, the industry has somehow tried to protect itself from getting into a big, you know, comparison chart.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the vendor shouldn't have some responsibility. The word here that vendors have a huge responsibility to
Question in back. Yes.
Okay, but here's why. Okay, and I'm all for firewalls, by the way. I believe in defense in depth, and there are many security products that are necessary as part of a defense in depth strategy. But here's the deal. If somebody, to give you an example, and again, I'm not averse to a defense in depth. If somebody comes to me and says, God forbid, I found a technical term, big honking hole in your application server or your database or whatever. What is the conversation I'm going to have with them? Is it going to be, well, they have one of those specialty firewalls that prevents certain class X type of attack? Oh, you do? Great, because I'm not going to fix this. They're going to have my head. So the reason, I found from all the other reasons why customers should make this a purchasing criterion is you need to look at the all-in cost of ownership. A lot of people think it's a license cost. Wrong. Let me finish my statement, please. If you are constantly patching your systems because the vendor didn't do a good job, that is a cost of supporting that vendor's product. One customer I know, and thank God it wasn't our software, I'm not naming names, said, but it was an extremely big defense customer, said, and they spend the cost of vendor X's software over again applying security patches. That's double the license cost. So at the end of the day, if you don't make it a security purchasing criterion, it's either pay now or pay later. Do you need, IDS systems? Yes. Do you need antivirus? Yes. That's all prudent. Do you need firewalls? Do they protect against certain classes of attacks? Yes. But they're not going to save you if your enterprise software vendors do a rotten job of it. You're going to have to patch those things anyway, and you're going to be vulnerable anyway.
Okay, we've had a hand up in back.
I agree. I think that I have a rather paternalistic, arrogant attitude about I know better than the customers. I think that, yeah.
I believe you,
yeah.
Bill.
No, I think it's like medicine. I mean, pharmaceutical companies and doctors know how to, build, interleukin-2, interferon, whatever, high-tech drugs. You don't have the customers tell you that they want you to build it this way.
In back, you've had your hand up for some time.
Well, I think there's the resources are available for people if you want to find it. But I think the problem is it's the cost of training is so high to basically reteach your programmers versus the automated scanning tools and also the if you were truly starting a product from scratch and you had a whole team of secure program developers, it would take years for your code to get out, I would think. I would say, who's starting a new product from scratch? You don't write Oracle from scratch each time. You already have this code base you must maintain, right? And so that's why scanning code audit tools are so interesting to you because you have such legacy code. But if you could build the super programming team that never made a programming fault and could start from scratch, well,
have a relatively new product, and that has already goes through the same development processes, and we put it through the same development processes. And again, the economics for us, I sort of have two factors. One of them is because we run on so many operating systems, it costs us a boatload. Okay, that's again, I hate to put economics first because you think that's all that motivates me. But at the end of the day, it's much more than that. I mean, the company started, I think probably a lot of people know this, the Central Intelligence wanted a commercial relational database. That was the contract, was Project Oracle, and that was the founding of the company. So we started out by helping someone protect national secrets. That's part of our corporate culture. I'm accountable to them. I'm accountable to every customer. But yes, I've had four CIOs of the four, with respect and affection, professional paranoids in front of me. Those are the people I worry about. So, it is a moral issue. You are accountable to your customers. They trust you. We tell them to run your mission critical systems on our software. It means that they better be able to trust it. You know, I think this is something, the real issue across the industry is cultural. You know, security has always been somebody else's job. It's the security team's job. It's the funny people, you know, wearing uniforms at the front desk job. Wrong. It is everyone's job because most security faults are not a failure of the security mechanisms, they are a result of bad programming. So I tell every developer, you personally are accountable for every line of code you write. It is not the QA people's job to make you write better code. You have to write better code.
JD?
I don't find that statement to be true. I mean, there are mistakes, there are bad coders, but you know, there's a lot of good coders. I'm sure you have a lot of good coders on your team. But let's say you instituted, you know, government evaluations and you came up with, you know, good guidelines for security. Well, who are you going to keep out? I've seen, you know, C2 was great at keeping regular people out. C2 doesn't keep. So you think today? I mean, you know, who's really tried to, you know, exceed it? So my point is that, you know, coming up with all of these regulations, do good coding for, you know, well-designed software doesn't meet the criteria of keeping people who want to really apply their brain power to, you know, breaking it.
You mean the example of having to downgrade your crypto to be FIPS compliant on certain products?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. In the back.
I didn't look at specifically within the hours, but I think you're absolutely right. We have seen a trend of vulnerabilities and exploits becoming out within hours there. And I think there is it's a lot about how the release of the vulnerability is coordinated by the vendor. That's going to deliver a lot about the success, how we can survive the particular exploit in this case. Like the Cisco case was a phenomenal example, I think, how it was handled and how the internet got fixed before it actually became out to the wild. I think a lot of it is depending on the individual vendor coming back, how it's being handled. But I think on a bigger picture perspective, if you take the bigger numbers, it's about two half-lives roughly, where you see about 80% of the exploits coming out there. But I can go back actually to the data and look more specifically within the hours. So it's an interesting suggestion actually.
Yes.
Yeah, one question. What is the
The only problem, I think, is it's going to push the cost of writing software up to only medium and large scale players, and will really, I mean, all it takes is one bad line of code and you're out of business now. And so really, what's the incentive to try a startup if you have one mistake and you're out of business? So I think some kind of legislation is important. I like the notification law in California. I think that's an interesting first step, and I want to see what happens with that. But I'm always cautious when people tell me that a law will solve the social problem. And the social problem here is bad coding practice. And so, yeah, that makes me nervous.
It's not entirely a social problem. Well, it's also very hard to do.
Well, but, right. I mean, it's a human physiological problem. It's not as simple as...
And by the way, I'm not intending this to be a cop-out, but there's actually another issue here. And one of them is, sure, if you have something like an automobile, the automobile isn't designed to do also be, depending on how you configure it, a microwave oven, a speedboat, or a helicopter. One of the challenges you have with software is that so much of it has to do with how is it used, how is it configured, and what else is it working with. In the case of things like packaged applications, depending on who the vendor is, so much of it is customization. So again, that doesn't mean that the vendors, oh, hey, I'm off the hook at somebody else's problem, but realize that when you deliver a product, you, in some cases, you don't really know how it's going to be used, and there are interdependencies with all these other things. So that does make it more complex. Part of the nature of software itself is that it is going to be prone to faults because it is large, complex, and a lot of working parts, and a lot of that complexity has to do with how it's used. Now again, if all else fails, the market will remediate. So when you do have some of these things passed, even if they're not, they're well-intended laws that aren't well-written, such as SB 1386, it's going to force people to do certain things that in many respects they probably should have been doing anyway. And that's not all a bad thing, because the market ended up pricing everyone. So you're all going to have to do a better job, because now the companies who buy your software or implement it are going to be held accountable if certain types of information is breached.
Yes. Thank you. One more over here. Green. Okay, I think this is a good place to segue back to Gerhard for the conclusion of his presentation.
So where are we going from here? I think the intention here fundamentally is to shorten the cycle, shorten the half-life, and take a look in where can we eliminate or remove or shorten the window of exposure, make it smaller, make the window of exposure smaller. And I think there's basically two attack points here that we can see on this slide here. Certainly we can eliminate, we can make the half-life shorter, but we can also make sure that vulnerabilities are not reappearing as they were gone or supposed to be gone before. And so the intention here, I'm asking all the audience here for support that we come back in a year from today in 2004 at the conference, and hopefully we have achieved the ability to bring back the half-life of 30 days into 15 days, which means we have a window of exposure of 30 days rather than 60 days, what we have today. So what are we doing from our end to support that initiative and that effort? We have built up a blog that we made available, and we invite all of you, or those of you who are interested in, www.wunds.com, become a contributor, discuss on a continuous and an ongoing effort the law of vulnerabilities, as well as the top 10 most prevalent vulnerabilities. And that's something we will be continuing updating as new vulnerabilities are becoming into the top 10 prevalent list. We're going to update the top 10 list there. And this is a continuous effort. It's going to be again published on www.wunds.com, where we continuously see when new vulnerabilities are becoming as part of the top 10. They will be immediately updated on this page as well. We also have made available a free assessment scanning tool for the top 10. So again, as the top 10 changes, as I mentioned before, it's about 50% of the top 10 are changing during the course of a year. It's being continuously updated and free and available to the community as well as a service. And that hopefully should get us closer to the goal to come back in a year from today and be able to say, this is where we are today. We have accomplished to shorten the half-life of vulnerabilities. At this point, I wanted to point out the current top 10 vulnerabilities that made it up to the most prevalent and critical vulnerabilities. As you can see, the DCOM is obviously on there. It's sorted by CVE ID, so it has no particular order within those top 10 here. And what's interesting to note here as well is it has on SSL v2 servers being enabled. So that's probably one of the priorities that you all may want to go back and look at your infrastructure and your environment, if you have any servers that may be still serving SSL v2 somewhere in your infrastructure. And then again, I wanted to invite all of you to our weblog, become even contributors, or just come in there and read the contents about the law. And it's going to be an ongoing discussion here where we'll be using this as an infrastructure, as a platform that we make available to the community, and hopefully come back in a year from today and report some updated good progress on the goal that we have set out here. At this point, I wanted to thank you all for listening. Thank you for coming, particularly. And thanks for all the interesting questions as well.